Hello, everybody. Welcome and thank you for coming. My name is Reem Ramawi, and I'm the president of Students for Justice in Palestine here at UNO. I would like to introduce David Sheen, a Canadian-Israeli independent journalist and filmmaker. Sheen began blogging when he first moved to Israel in 1999 and has written for many publications, including Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, and The Daily Beast. He has spoken throughout the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and is currently writing a book about African immigrants to Israel and the struggles that they face. Welcome to David Sheen.
Thank you so much for coming. People who weren't able to come out tonight will be able to see this material. And of course, I'm also going to be adding URLs so that when you see some of this stuff, you may find it hard to believe. You'll be able to go onto the internet afterwards and look this stuff up and verify. With the title that I've chosen, The Bullet, The Ballot, and The Boycott, people generally assume that I'm going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. But in fact, I'm not going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. I'm going to be speaking about Israel boycotting. Because I contend that Israel actually boycotts its own non-Jewish citizens in many facets of life. Notice that in this entire discussion, I have not once mentioned the Nakba. I have not once mentioned the Naqsa. I have not once mentioned the West Bank. I have not once mentioned Gaza. I have not once mentioned all the houses that were destroyed. I have not once mentioned 550 youth killed last summer. I have only been talking about what's happening inside pre-1967 Israel. Because there's this discourse, and maybe you've heard it here on campus or elsewhere, of liberal Zionists. And when the idea of boycotting Israel comes up, you know, then they're quick to jump in and say, wait a minute, that's not fair. It's not fair to boycott Israel, because if you're opposed to what Israel's doing in the territories, then you should boycott the territories, you should boycott the settlements, you should boycott goods and services that come out of the settlements. But don't boycott Israel, that's a separate entity altogether. Fine, in the West Bank, that's non-democratic Israel. But in the rest of the country, that's democratic Israel. Those are two separate entities. Now, of course, it's completely ridiculous. This is an artificial separation that has no basis in reality. It's one governing structure. It's one banking system. It's one army. You know, it's one system of oppression that manifests differently in two separate areas, but it's the same system. It's the same people responsible. And so I don't. That doesn't fly with me. But let's assume for a second. Let's run with that. Okay. Let's assume that there are two separate entities called democratic Israel and non-democratic Israel. Well, everything I've shown you so far is in so-called democratic Israel, right? That's so-called democratic Israel, where Palestinian people are boycotted. This is what I'm trying to explain to you, that Israel isn't a democracy, that in my mind, it's an ethnocracy, and that the rights and privileges are not accorded to people on the basis of citizenship, but on the basis of their ethnicity. That's bad enough, and no one should have to live like that one more day. But what's even worse is that we see in recent years there are forces within the society that are trying to take that ethnocracy and turn it into a theocracy. I'll explain what I mean by that. We're going to look at some of these groups, and we're going to look at their goals and their strategies and their tactics. So the goal of these Jewish dominionist groups, as I call them, is they want to create a theocracy. The strategy, the way to get there, is race war. That's what they want to pop off. And the tactics they're using to ignite that race war is arson, burning Palestinian trees, Palestinian cars, Palestinian mosques, Palestinian churches. And we see, in case you were wondering, we're not just talking about random acts of vandalism where, you know, it's just a couple kids who don't have anything to do on the weekends, so it's a way for them to get let off some steam. No. They leave graffiti at the scene of the crime, explaining in no uncertain terms why they do it. Now, keep in mind, when you see all this hatred towards Christian people in Israel, we're talking about something like 1-2% of the population. And yet, even though they are so few and far between, they're still considered, you know, they're still so despised by these Jewish dominionists. And not just burning mosques and churches, but even burning schools, if you can imagine this. So this school, first of all, at this point, I should put you on pause for a moment and just explain. We're talking about a country in which there has never been a Brown versus Board of Education moment. 99% of schools in Israel are still segregated by race and religion. Okay, there's only a handful of schools in the entire country, like 5 or 6 or 7 schools where Jews and Palestinians actually study together. This is a ridiculous state of affairs. But even those few schools are under attack against all odds. And so the only integrated school in the Jerusalem area was firebombed, again, by Jewish dominionists who left graffiti at the scene of the crime. If you can imagine this, burning a grade 1 classroom, the amount of hate that's required. And not only burning mosques and churches and schools, but now family homes. And we have 100 days ago in the village of Duma, outside of Nablus, an entire family was torched. It was a father, mother, and 1-year-old baby Ali murdered. It came up to the window of the family home. They threw Molotov cocktail in, and they waited outside watching as the home burnt and as the family burnt to death. Now, this is what we've come to. This is Israel in 2015. Now, of course, in every society, there are sick people, psychotic, homicidal, maniacs, racists, okay? But the question is, how does the government respond to these extremists? And the answer is poorly, because we look to not David Sheen, but Yuval Diskin, who until not too long ago was the head of the Shabak. That's Israel's FBI. Okay? And what he has to say just recently in response to the murders in Duma, he says that for now and forever, there's been a total lack of will to tackle this issue at the political level. So it's not that Israeli security services are incapable of tracking down, you know, doing simple detective work. They're thought of as, you know, these amazingly capable army and police force, and that's why y'all send your police forces to Israel supposedly to learn from them, and yet they're clearly capable of rounding up the criminals, but according to this top cop, the government doesn't want to. Well, they did actually manage to find those young men who torched that school, that integrated school in Jerusalem. Well, they got a sentence of 2 years for their crime. And as they were led out of the courthouse following sentencing, they began to sing praises to Yahweh, and they told, oh, that's strange. Well, there's a little glitch in the system, but what it's supposed to say is they told the media that it was worth it, the 2 years they served, or that they have to serve, a small price to pay for what they wanted to accomplish, burning one of the only integrated schools in the country. And again, this is the message that trickles down to the rest of the society when they understand that that all you're going to get is a little slap on the wrist and not much more than that, if anything, then it sends a message. And then that's what the youth absorb. So when just a couple months ago, Israeli high school students, Jewish Israeli high school students, were asked what they think of these so-called price tag attacks, these racist hate crimes on Palestinian people, I'm sad to say that a mere 28% of them outright condemned these racial hate crimes. So 72% of Jewish Israeli high school students were not willing to even outright condemn these racist hate crimes on Palestinian people. I don't mean to suggest, though, that that's 100%. Okay, it's an unfortunate figure, but there are some people who do come out and criticize these disgusting, horrendous, horrific crimes. And so just recently, in fact, the day after the Doabsha family was murdered horrifically, this man, a mayor of a town in northern Israel, he actually went onto Facebook and he posted a message to his constituents and went like this. He wrote, "Around us, we are seeing more and more displays of hatred and violence that make us all cringe. This is the time to remember the most important commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself. Let's stop hating. And as it says in the book of Psalms, turn from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it." So I'm glad that he had the courage to come out and say something about this. And truth be told, it is an act of courage, increasingly so in Israeli society, because the very next day after he said this, his car was torched right in front of his house, if you can imagine this, for merely calling for peace and love, for merely criticizing the murder of a Palestinian family. So let's just say this is a disincentive to speak out in the name of peace. Now, let's talk a little bit about these Jewish dominionist groups. So, as I said, at these At the site of these attacks, the perpetrators often leave graffiti behind, explaining their motivation. And this was also the case for the Doabsha family that was murdered. And what the perpetrators wrote on the walls of their home was, Yechi HaMelech HaMashiach, a crown there. In English, long live the king, the Messiah. This phrase was not of their own imagination. It's actually a phrase that you see, it's quite common across the country in Israel. Graffiti and posters and signs. It's actually the motto of this group, Chabad. I don't know if they operate right here on campus, but I'm pretty positive that they do operate in New Orleans, in Louisiana, across the country. They're considered to be one of the largest, if not the largest, Jewish religious sect in the world. And this is a group that has amassed no small amount of political power here in the United States. We see them meeting in the Oval Office with American presidents as far back as Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, George Bush II, and of course with Barack Obama. So who are these people that have amassed so much power, and what is their ideology? So when we go to their foundational texts, their religious manifestos, Hatanya, that's the name of their holy book, and we read the writings of Menachem Schneerson, their spiritual leader. He's since passed on, but he's considered to be their messianic figure. And so when we read the Tanya and we read the writings of Schneerson, this is what we find in regards to non-Jewish people. He says, the souls of the nations of the world, that's y'all, emanate from unclean spheres, which contain no good whatsoever. The Jewish body looks as if it were in substance similar to bodies of non-Jews, but the difference is so great that the bodies should be considered as completely different species. I'm no biologist, but I'm pretty sure that I'm not of the species Homo sapiens Judaicus. I'm pretty sure we have the same DNA, but according to Chabad ideology, we don't. And so he goes on, that's the body. What about the soul? An even greater difference exists in regard to the soul. Two contrary types of soul exist. A non-Jewish soul comes from three satanic spheres, while the Jewish soul stems from holiness. This is Chabad. Now, we see also that they have made inroads in Israel, and they meet with Benjamin Netanyahu, and when they do, he's happy to wear a kippah, skull cap, with that same motto inscribed upon it. But it's not that Netanyahu is their lawmaker of choice. He's not even their favorite parliamentarian. In fact, Chabad much prefers his challenger to the right, because in the Likud, the ruling Likud party, there's, of course, internal elections. And so Netanyahu is often challenged by candidates who are even more right-wing than he is, if you can imagine that. And so this man, Moshe Feiglin, consistently challenged Netanyahu for the leadership of the party. And he is the man that Chabad holds in highest regard. Last summer, when he was deputy speaker of the Knesset, this is while, you know, the massacre was going on in Gaza, this is what he had to say. The IDF, the Israeli army, shall designate certain open areas in which the civilian population will be concentrated. Subsequent to the elimination, Gaza will become part of Israel and will be populated by Jews. So open calls for ethnic cleansing. And this is the Israeli lawmaker that the Chabad movement flies around the world, Canada, Australia, to come speak at their synagogues and community centers. This is their ideological, political ally. But of course, you don't need to go into the political realm. You can simply stay in the religious realm. And we see that the top Chabad rabbis in Israel also are making six statements of their own. So this man, the top Chabad rabbi Yitzchak Ginzburg, he's the head of a Jewish dominionist movement in Israel. And what he did was a few years back, he gave his religious authorization to this book, Torat HaMelech. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, The King's Torah. I'm just going to speak about it for a moment. It's pretty sick, actually. It's essentially a theological, treatise that asks the question, under what circumstance may a Jew kill a non-Jew, it asks. And it comes to the conclusion that under pretty much any circumstance, the author of the book says that there is justification for killing babies if it is clear they'll grow up to harm us. Babies. And this top Chabad rabbi was the one who gave that, who wrote the introduction to the book, who started the book off by saying, yes, this book follows all the precepts of Jewish religious law. This is an authentic interpretation of halakha. He gave it his asmachta, his seal of approval. This is Chabad. So Chabad rabbi authorizes, in theory, killing babies, and then adherents to Chabad ideology go out and actually burn a baby and leave the Chabad motto at the scene of the crime. Now, I didn't mention it earlier, but there was another member of the family who was also burned in that fire from head to toe, burns over his entire body, and it wasn't clear at all that he was going to survive. He was in the hospital for months, and while he was there, this man, an Israeli rabbi, leader of the Reform movement in Israel, a liberal stream of Judaism, he actually organized a prayer session outside of the hospital. I don't want you to think that this is all Jewish religious groups that speak this way about non-Jewish people. And here's an example of the contrary. So Gilad Kariv, he organized Muslim imams and Christian priests and himself, a rabbi, and they got together at that hospital and they held an interfaith, interreligious prayer session to pray for the speedy recovery of Ahmed Dawabshe, the 9-year-old brother who survived, the sole survivor of that family. But he said some interesting stuff at that ceremony that he conducted, and this is what he had to say. I thought was quite interesting. He said, those doing price tag attacks, that's the euphemism, the Israeli euphemism, that's what they call these racist hate crimes on Palestinians. Okay, so those doing price tag attacks are doing real Jewish acts, just as we are doing Jewish acts here by praying for his recovery. Right? In the Jewish writings, you can find humanistic writings next to dark ideas, and the two are the two faces of Judaism. Until we understand this, we won't be able to fight for the leading voice of Judaism. It's not that those who carry out hate crimes are a distortion of Judaism and that we are the true Judaism. No, it is a struggle between two options of Judaism. All right, now we've talked about Chabad. That's one of these Jewish dominionist groups. Now I'm going to talk about a second Jewish dominionist group, the Jewish Home Party. And this is a party that's in the Knesset and in the government. And we see that a prominent feature of their politics is bringing convicted terrorists into the government. And I'll show you what I mean. So Yinon Magal, one of these leading lawmakers of the Jewish Home Party, of course, a famous quote by him, the Arab nation, all it brings to the world is murder and blood. Yinon Magal, he calls for Jews to return to the Temple Mount. It's like the last place in Palestine that they're still under Muslim sovereignty. After every other square inch of the country is controlled by the state, by the Israeli state, it's like the last place where Muslims have some control over their own religious activities. And so he says, no, we need to take back, we need to ascend to the Temple Mount, and he wants to fight for Jewish rights there. And of course, he writes this on Facebook, and he uploads a photo of himself chilling with the very person who sat in jail as a convicted terrorist for plotting to blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque, okay? So bringing on board convicted terrorists, saying, yeah, we're going to fight for the rights to have rights on Al-Aqsa Mosque, posing with the person who went to jail for trying to blow it up. And we see Ayelet Shaked, another member of the Jewish Home Party, and she's, of course, last summer, she said, who is the enemy? The Palestinian people are all enemy combatants. This also includes the mothers. So there's no such thing as a civilian. According to her, every Palestinian person deserves to be killed, right? Because they're all militants. They're all soldiers. Men, women, children, it doesn't matter. So this is Ayelet Shaked. Now, I kept seeing her. I noticed that she was meeting with this man, this bearded man. And again, also, I noticed that the leader of the Jewish Home Party, Naftali Bennett, was doing the same, okay? This is someone who's gone on record as saying, I've killed many Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that. So we see where he's coming from. But same thing with him. I see that he was consistently meeting with this bearded man. I kept noticing that they made public appearances together in different locales, and including in the Knesset itself, meeting in the very halls of the Knesset. And I didn't really know what to make of this, and then I started digging a little bit, and it turns out this is Natan Natanzon, none other than part of a group of convicted terrorists who sat in jail for attempting to assassinate several Palestinian mayors, and in fact succeeding in this case of blowing off this man's legs. This man was the mayor of Nablus, and sure enough, these Jewish terrorists actually set off bombs, and they didn't manage to kill him, but they blew off both his legs. Okay, so this man who sat in jail for being part of a group that blew off this man's legs is now brought into the halls of power by the Jewish Home Party. This is how they operate. This is what they say, and this is what they do. So you can have a sense of what's coming around the corner, what to expect from them in the next session of the Knesset. So we've talked about the Chabad, Jewish Dominionists. We've talked about the Jewish Home, Jewish Dominionists. And now we're going to talk about a third group, Lehava. Now, just as the Jewish Home Party brings in convicted terrorists and Jewish supremacists into the halls of power, we see that no less, it's just as much a tactic of the ruling Likud Party. So these Jewish supremacists were invited by Israel's top diplomats. Today, these people are Israel's top diplomats. Tzipi Chotoveli is Israel's acting foreign minister. Danny Danon is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. Chotoveli was the one who invited Lehava into the Knesset, and Danon was the one who hosted them. Okay. Now, who is this group, Lehava? So, again, put you on pause for a moment, just to explain some context. Zoom out. Let's look at the macro for a moment. In Israel, there's no way for people of different religions to get married to one another. Okay, Jews and non-Jews can't marry. That's not by accident. That's by design. That's very much on purpose. Okay, when secular Jews established the state of Israel, okay, they jettisoned most of the Orthodox Judaism that was, you know, that were features of Jewish life in Europe and in the Arab world. But one of the few things that they kept from Orthodox Judaism was this prohibition on marriage, marrying out. Okay, so, okay, admittedly, it is physically possible. If you're rich enough, you can get your whole family and fly them out here to New Orleans and go down to City Hall and get married there and then fly back to the country and then it's a fait accompli and then you're married. But most people don't have those kinds of funds, to say the least, and it's just, again, it's a disincentive. It's part of the state's efforts to make it all that much more difficult. And so it's extremely rare, actually. But even though it's so rare for Jews and non-Jews to marry one another, this is something that these Jewish Dominionists despise, because not only do they want dominion, but they want separation, total separation. And so when they learn that there are couples who meet and fall in love against all odds, they do their level best to smash them. And so last summer, this man, Mahmoud, he's the son of Muslim citizens of Israel, and this woman, Moral, she's the daughter of Jewish citizens of Israel. They grew up in Yaffa, and they met and fell in love and decided they're going to spend their lives together, have a big party to celebrate with their... It doesn't matter if they're officially married. On paper, they decided to, you know, to throw a party and celebrate their union. And if you can imagine this, on the day of their wedding, they have hundreds of these Jewish supremacists protesting outside the wedding hall, screaming, "Mavet la'aravim." Death to the Arabs. This is the group Lehava, and they're brought into the Knesset. And in fact, they were invited into the Knesset today. Today, they were invited into the Knesset to speak. This is what we've come to. Now, we should also say about Lehava that, I don't know, for the last couple of years, we haven't seen figures yet, but until a couple of years ago, they were actually receiving government funding to the tune of the equivalent of $166,000 a year through their sister organization from the Israeli government. And it's not only shekels they're receiving, it's dollars as well. So y'all also subsidize this activity in some small ways. You see, remember earlier I spoke about those two young men who torched that joint Jewish-Arab school in Jerusalem. They were members of Lehava who perpetrated that. Now, you saw they went to court. Now, who paid for their legal fees? You did, actually, in part, because there are charities operating here in the United States that raise money and send that money to Israel to pay for the legal fees of those Jewish supremacist terrorists, okay? And those charities are tax exempt, meaning that your tax money subsidizes those funds that are raised and sent to Israel to pay for the legal fees of those terrorists. So we're all a little bit complicit here. Now, with all this burning and looting going on, it kind of begs the question, you know, something's got to be done about this. And I'm not the only journalist in the country that's covering it. And so another journalist kind of cornered Bensi Gupstein, the leader of Lehava, and he just asked him straight out, you know, how are you in favor of burning churches in the land of Israel? Yes or no? An easy opportunity for him to play coy, to evade the question. But no, he just said straight up, you have to burn. Yes, of course, simply yes. Why are you even asking? You have any doubt? This is his response. And life continues, and he's still invited to speak in public forums. So this is the head of Lehava, and we see that they have their motto in the background here, Kahana Tzadak, or Kahana was right. And you see this actually graffitied all around the country, Kahana Tzadak, the most common, maybe the second most common, I'd say, graffiti tag around the country. Now, who is this Kahana that he's referencing that was right? This is a reference to the founding father of Israeli fascism, this man, Meir Kahana. He was a member of the Knesset back in the 1980s, and he used the same shtick, the same kinds of, tricks, holding up a noose. I guess you can imagine what he wanted to do with it. Now, the differences between 2015 and, three decades ago is, at that time, these ideas, the ideas of Lehava, of Kahana, of these Jewish dominionists, were considered beyond the pale. They were considered so far gone, completely racist, that that at that time, you have actually, while he's a member of the Knesset, you have a leading member of the ruling Likud party, Michael Eitan. He actually steps up in the Knesset itself, on the dais, and he calls out Kahana. And he says, you Kahana, you are no different than Hitler. And this is in the Knesset. And he breaks it down, point by point. And he says, Kahana, you're no different than Hitler. You want to cancel the Camp David peace treaty. Hitler canceled the Versailles peace treaty. You want to make the Communist Party illegal. Hitler made the Communist Party illegal. You want to make it illegal to sell non-kosher food. Hitler made it illegal to sell kosher food. You want to make it so non-Jews can't live in Jerusalem. Hitler did the same thing for Jews living in Berlin or Munich. You want to make it so non-Jews can't vote or hold public office. Hitler did the same for Jews in Germany. You want to make it so non-Jews and Jews can't go to school together, and Hitler did the same thing. You don't want to allow non-Jews and Jews to swim in the same public pools. The same thing in Nazi Germany. And of course, the classic, you want to make it so that non-Jews and Jews can't marry or even have sex. And of course, that was part and parcel of Nazi legislation. So there are a lot of parallels, and at that time that Kahana was in the Knesset, at least even the Israeli right wing called it out. Even the Israeli ruling Likud party saw this as so disgusting that they broke it down and compared it point by point to Nazi ideology. But today, we're in a completely different political reality, 30 years later. So Kahana no longer exists. He has since been assassinated. He was killed on the streets of New York City in the 1990s. Okay, but even though he's gone, his legend lives on, you can say. And he's become iconified. And his image is reproduced, and his ideas are brought to bear in this day and age. And so it's not uncommon to see people wearing regalia featuring Kahana himself, like this young man, Kahana Tzadak. Again, Kahana was right, except that now, if at that time Israeli government and members of the government were embarrassed by Kahana, now it's no longer embarrassing to be associated. You have Miri Regev, the top female official in the Israeli government, in the Israeli ruling Likud party, the minister of culture, taking selfies with young man wearing Kahana regalia, because it's no longer embarrassing to be associated with Kahana, apparently, for Israel's leaders. Now, again, Kahana is no longer alive, but his grandson continues on the tradition. His grandson is one of the leading ideologues of these Jewish dominionists. And sure enough, now he, spends his time writing articles calling for violent attacks on Palestinian people. But a few years ago, what he was doing, he was, still in his ideological diapers, I guess. And at that point, Sometimes you hear about settlement expansion. You know, you hear about Palestinian lands being, gobbled up, and you hear that settlements keep growing and growing. But despite the fact that they're growing at rapid rate, for some of these settlers, it's not fast enough. They want the government to go faster and faster and more and more, and they're mad at the government for not expanding quick enough. And so sometimes some of these settlers actually, if you can imagine this, they actually attack the Israeli army. This is part of their plan to, to kind of take, they see it as taking revenge and striking back at the government for not acceding to their demands to gobble up Palestinian land quick enough. And so sometimes these settler extremists will actually attack Israeli army vehicles and soldiers, and they'll puncture their tires or they'll throw stones at them. And then, of course, the army tries to chase them down and capture them and arrest them. So while they're playing, of course, they would never shoot them or anything like that, right? Because they're Jews. But while they're playing this cat and mouse game of trying to catch these settlers, they were actually getting help. They were getting text messages saying, no, don't go in this thing, go in this direction. No, the army's coming from here, so go around this way. So helping them evade capture by the Israeli army. Now, how was it that someone had that kind of information, that they were able to be fed this info? Well, it turns out that man who was texting them was none other than Ze'ev Elkin, who at that time was the whip of the ruling Likud party and the whip of Israel's government, an actual member of the Knesset, and since then he's been promoted to minister. In other countries, I imagine someone who helps criminals evade security forces would be on trial for treason, but in Israel, that's a cause for promotion. And so this is how cops and clan work hand in hand in Israel. I've made the case for how these Jewish dominionists are slowly sweeping into power, taking over. But if there was any doubt about it, we have the words of Israel's defense minister, Moshe Alon, who, talking about the Dawabshah family that was burnt to death over 100 days ago, till this day, we don't have any indictment. We don't have anyone on trial. We don't have any names or faces. And it's not because we don't know who did it. Well, at least the Israeli government says it does. The defense minister says that Israel knows who is responsible, but has chosen to prevent legal recourse to protect the identity of their sources. Are you getting this? So, the reason why they know who did it is because they have spies working with these Jewish supremacist terrorists. But if they bring them to court, then they'll have to give testimony. These spies will have to say, this is what I saw, this is what I heard, and then everyone will know who they are, and then they won't be able to continue to spy. So in the interests of being able to continue to spy on these groups, they're willing to keep them in the dark, and it's not important enough to bring these murderers to trial. Even the death of a Palestinian baby, that's how little Palestinian lives matter. I know it's a lot to listen to, and I don't give you much reason for hope, but I feel it's important, that you know this stuff, because this is the reality on the ground, and this is what I have to go back to.